Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former CIA Director George Tenet's big new memoir is officially out today, and the country's top spy chief in the run-up to 9/11 and the Iraq War is hopping mad. He's angry that George Bush's inner circle made him the fall guy for Iraq, taking his phrase slam dunk and making him look, he says, like Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah Winfrey's couch. He's mad about inaction before 9/11, about the rush to Iraq war after. But what about his role? Up next on Point, George Tenet speaks. We'll get the inside view and roll tape on the former CIA chief's indictment of the road to war he shared. Joining me now from Washington is John Diamond, former national security correspondent for USA Today. He's author of a soon-to-be-released new book on U.S. intelligence from the end of the Cold War to 9/11. John Diamond, good to have you.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Tyler Drumheller, one of the CIA's most senior officers in intelligence collection under George Tenet. He's former head of covert operations in Europe, served 26 years with the CIA. He's author of On the Brink, an insider's account of how the White House compromised American intelligence. Tyler Drumheller, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington, Ron Suskind, Pulitzer Prize-winning former Wall Street Journal national affairs writer and author of the big book, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Ron, great to have you with us today.
It's good to be here, Tom.
So here we are, some incredible tape last night on 60 Minutes, and we will hear a bunch of it, thanks to CBS for that in this hour. Here's the book with everything laid out. John Diamond, you were covering it at the time. Is this a new George Tenet on display here? Is this the guy who was in there with the president all along? What do you see in this book and when George sits down with Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes?
Well, I think that Director Tenet was a very political DCI. It's interesting that he was really a second choice. You may remember Donald Rumsfeld was going to be head of CIA. And he and Cheney together decided it would be a better power base for them to have Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, which turned out to be a correct decision. Tenet, although he carried over from the Clinton administration, nevertheless comes across in the book and I think came across during his tenure as very political, deeply involved in policy discussions, not just presenting his version of just the facts. And I think that his sort of passionate disagreements with policymakers now who are still in the administration, including the vice president, suggest the degree to which he was involved.
Ron Suskind, what do you see then on display here? I mean, a $4 million book deal, he's got to deliver some heat, and he's doing that right now. But is George Tenet now finally giving the American people the sort of unvarnished truth of the road to war with Iraq, or is this still politics? How do you read it, Ron?
Well, a lot of what's in George's book has been reported before. Certainly a lot of it was in the 1% Doctrine, mm-hmm. but elsewhere as well. And I think this is really George's personal statement of outrage more than anything else. And it's interesting, you know, those of us who've spent some time with Tenet to watch 60 Minutes and see him in what is called full Tenet mode, where he just is all over the camera. I mean, you know, eyes wide, you know, veins popping out of his neck. This is certainly a view that is not unfamiliar to Musharraf of Pakistan or Abdullah of Saudi Arabia.
That's his style, man. I mean, he was angry, roiling all over the place, kind of skittish, even rattled looking sometimes. I don't know how to describe it.
Well,
exactly.
You know, I don't know if it engendered a lot of confidence in the viewer as to a man who is the custodian, the steward of so many important national security secrets of the United States, certainly during this time of peril.
Tyler Drumheller, you were right there in the midst of it from your seat in Europe. Let's listen to a little bit of George Tenet last night on 60 Minutes just to get a sense of the man. He began talking about his urgent warnings, he said, to Condoleezza Rice in the summer before 9/11, saying there was something going on, action needed to be taken.
Essentially, the briefing says there are going to be multiple spectacular attacks against the United States. We believe these attacks are imminent. mass casualties are a likelihood. You're telling Condoleezza Rice in that meeting in the White House in July that we should take offensive action in Afghanistan now, before 9/11.
We need to consider immediate action inside Afghanistan now. We need to move to the offensive.
Take that, says George Tenet. I told you to do something. Of course, it wasn't done. There was not an offensive in Afghanistan. 9/11 came. Scott Pelley asked George Tenet what he was thinking when the Twin Towers came down.
After all these years of planning and plotting and wanting to capture or kill Osama bin Laden,
right.
You must have thought the SOB got me first.
Yeah, but I had another thought. I'm going to run you and all your bastards down, and here we come. Because the rules are about to change. Here we come. Our turn now. Unleashed. Authorities. Money. Direction. Leadership. Here we come, pal. That's what I thought.
Our turn now. Unleashed. Tyler Drumheller, you were in the CIA at that time. What do you hear when George Tenet says, okay, here we come, Osama? Was that the general sense of the agency, or was there still a clear and sober analysis of what was going on?
Well, no, it certainly captured the way he felt. I think the way Kofor Black and the Counterterrorism Center, and everybody at the agency took it, as did the whole country, but really took it as there was a tremendous shock to the system of the agency, a sense of failure amongst a lot of people. But there then ensued a debate that went on over the next, it's still going on, over how much to depend on these sort of very aggressive paramilitary-type operations, and then classic intelligence work. And there was a sense right away that, well, everything we did before is useless. Now we're just going to go get them and do this. Well, the fact is you have to have a balance of all that. And I think that, as John and Ron said last night, what you saw was, I know George Tenet very well for a long time, and that was George when he's cornered and sort of coming out fighting, sort of brushing over things very quickly that he doesn't want to talk about, and then sort of getting in the face of the person he's talking to make his point, even when the point doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Also, the one thing he did do is I do believe he honestly felt very strongly for the people of the service, and that is one area where he's consistent. It's how he carried it out that was a little bit of problematic.
He's saying we were the ones, maybe the only ones, telling the truth here. Pelley pressed him hard on this issue of balance when it comes to torture and whether or not that unleashed CIA was going for the torture handle right away. Listen to George Tenet's response on that interaction.
You know, the image that's been portrayed is we sat around the campfire and said, oh boy, now we go get to torture people. Well, we don't torture people. Let me say that again to you. We don't torture people.
Okay? Come on,
so,
George.
We don't torture people.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
We don't torture people.
Waterboarding.
We do not. I don't talk about techniques, and we don't torture people. Now, listen to me. I want you to listen to me. So the context is, it's post 9/11. I've got reports of nuclear weapons in New York City, apartment buildings that are going to be blown up, planes that are going to fly into airports all over again. Plot lines that I don't know. I don't know what's going on inside the United States, and I'm struggling to find out where the next disaster is going to occur. Everybody forgets one central context of what we lived through. The palpable fear that we felt on the basis of the fact that there was so much we did not know.
George Tenet last night on CBS, I want you to listen to me sitting there, John Diamond. What are we learning now that he's got his $4 million book out there, now that he's pointing fingers in so many directions? Ron Suskind says a lot of this has been written already. Is there a new edge to what's being unfolded here, or just a new edge to the animosity between Tenet and the Bush administration?
It was interesting to me to see Dan Bartlett refer to George as a patriot on a week when George has been unloading on senior people within Dan Bartlett, within the Bush administration.
No.
I think that he is a passionate person. He has a reputation for that. It's genuine. Whether it sort of comes across well for his sake on TV is another question. I think that his almost frantic-sounding description of the environment after 9/11, to me, the way some of the different big pieces of the Tenet story connect together are interesting. The October National Intelligence Estimate of 2002, which we now know is completely wrong about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, is happening at a time when the CIA is under the spotlights, on the grill basically, being examined for the failures of intelligence relating to 9/11. In other words, there were all sorts of things going on, small clues, hints of attacks coming that were not caught. 9/11 happens. Tenet is now seeing the World Trade Center in ruins. His agency is under tremendous pressure to explain what went wrong, what they failed to do beforehand. That's all happening at the time when they're asked on a completely different track to look at the Iraq threat, which was a threat picture that was full of circumstantial evidence of the kind that was also present on 9/11, which led to the attack. So it was, I think in that context, it becomes a little easier to understand how difficult it was to just for the CIA to pull a 180 under Tenet and just dismiss the threat from Iraq. I think the pressure context is very important.
We're talking this hour about George Tenet and the former CIA chief's new after-the-fact indictment of the Bush administration. The nub of it, the thing that's really got people's attention, is this charge that the White House was determined to go to war no matter what the intelligence. And, of course, that's been out there and said a lot, but now we've got the head of the CIA saying it. Let's listen to a little bit of tape on that first. Hear from George Tenet talking on 60 Minutes about running into Richard Perle, who was on the Defense Advisory Board close to the Pentagon at that time, the day after 9/11, September
12th, 2001. He said to me, Iraq has to pay a price for what happened yesterday. They bear responsibility. It's September the 12th. I've got the manifests with me that tell me that Al-Qaeda did this. Nothing in my head that says that there's any Iraqi involvement in this in any way, shape, or form. And I remember thinking to myself as I'm about to go in and brief the president, what the hell is he talking about?
You said Iraq made no sense to you in that moment. Does it make any sense to you today?
In terms of complicity with 9/11? Absolutely none. It never made any sense. We could never verify that there was any Iraqi authority, direction, and control, complicity with Al-Qaeda for 9/11 or any operational act against America, period.
Ron Suskind, okay, there it is. The former CIA chief says no connection, no ifs, ands, or buts. But, of course, Cheney and others have asserted that repeatedly. On the other hand, as John Diamond pointed out, this is also the George Tenet who handed the White House that 2002 National Intelligence Estimate about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So does George Tenet get to wash his hands here a little, a lot, not at all?
Well, you know, let's do a little connect the dots here, Tom. Mm. First off, the disclosure that it was about Iraq overthrowing Saddam Hussein from the very first National Security Council meeting of 2001 is from the price of loyalty. It's not just Paul O'Neill. It's everybody in the room. Mm-hmm. George now says, yes, that essentially was right. I think the best way to think about this is that from the beginning, it was about the hows, how to overthrow Saddam. What do we do once we own that country? Not the whys. The whys were already decided, well, prior to the start of this administration. That's one point. The second point is that right now, as to connections, what connects to what, how evidence was marshaled, you know, evidence is almost not a word to use here. This was about selling this idea. It was about packaging and presentation and message. George's job as the CIA chief is really to be the guardian of evidence. That actually bled into lots of other things. We can see that now. But ultimately, what you see with this administration from the beginning is they make certain decisions, and then as a kind of backfill, John DiIulio said this to me one point in that Esquire piece, evidence is backfill. The data, the facts are backfill. We decide to do it. Let's find facts essentially to support that case. We've done this in many, many instances. We can list them. I mean, it's the length of your arm.
Yep.
And we did it with Iraq. Tenet is right now in a position where before this moment, he had to defend largely indefensible positions on issues of evidence. And that's going to be a very slippery slope for him even now.
Tyler Drumheller, you were inside the CIA when all this was going on. So you got the internal chatter, I guess, plus what we all saw on the outside, in the trenches, where you were, and high placed in those trenches, were people in the CIA saying, what in the heck is our director doing, you know, backfilling apparently for whatever the White House wants?
Well, there was a terrific debate inside the CIA that began in Ron's right after they came into office, this administration, we had a meeting with the Deputy Director of Operations, Jim Pavitt, and this is in my book, they said, essentially, we're switching from Iran and al-Qaeda to Iraq is now the number one priority for operations inside the agency. That was in February of 2002. From that point on, everything, it was not a question of if or when. It was a question of when, not if or whether or not we would do it. And there was an initial plan to attack in April, and then it got pushed off to the fall, and then it got pushed off to the next year. In there was a debate, a ferocious debate within the analytical community, within the element called WINPEC, which is the weapons of mass destruction part of the analytical section of the agency. And then later on, in September of that year, the director of operations, which I was in, was brought into it, because the sources on this mostly came from the Defense Intelligence Agency and from overseas. And this is the part that George is going to have a hard time with. And he takes a shot at me in his book, and that's fine. He's done it since. Actually, he took a shot at me before any of this came out, after I testified to the Silberman Robb report. Mm. But the fact is that I'm sure he was upset by all this, but he was the director of CIA. It was his job to stand up and say that the intelligence on this is murky, and he knew in the summer of 2002, he knew for me in the fall of 2002, and he knew in January and February of 2002 that there were serious problems with the intelligence, at least questions. Now, he always says, well, we should have issued a fabrication notice and all that. Again, that's disingenuous, because you don't do that until you've met the agent, and we haven't even met the agent. But when you raise questions like this, you should be smart enough to know that you don't use this as an excuse, as the reason to go to war.
So he knew, you say, and you knew, you say, but the country, the world we're sitting out there, listen with us for a second, Tyler, to this exchange from last night between Tenet and Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes, of that moment, critical moment in terms of public understanding of this, when Secretary of State then Colin Powell went before the United Nations February 03 and said without question that Iraq had a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. Of course, those never showed up. Pelley raised it.
Conservative estimate of 100 to 500 tons?
Scott.
I mean, how can you be so wrong?
Scott, we've gone through this. It's what we believed. It's what we wrote.
Where do these numbers come from?
From our national intelligence estimate. I mean, you don't make this kind of stuff up.
Wait a minute, you did make this kind of stuff up.
No, we didn't make it up, Scott.
It's not true.
Scott, you're doing it again. You're impugning the integrity of people who make analytical judgments and make their best judgments about what they believe of the Iraqis possessed. Intelligence, you know, my business, is not always about the truth. It's about people's best judgments about what the truth may be. We believed it. We wrote it. We let the secretary down.
Wow. And there was Tenet, and we all remember it, Tyler, right over the shoulder of Colin Powell in that meeting. He says, you don't make this kind of stuff up. And yet he says, we kind of did. I'm hearing between the lines here.
Oh, I spoke to him the night before the speech and told him there were problems. I reminded him again, there were problems with the German reporting. Be careful with the German reporting. He said, yes, we're all exhausted. And at that point, it was pretty late. They weren't going to change it. But I had met with McLaughlin the week before, the deputy, and told him exactly that there were strong questions in his chief of staff, that there were strong problems with this case, that it could be the curveball case that they're talking about, that this could be a fabricator. This is the key case for the whole war. This is the one tangible piece of evidence. All the other things George is talking about are things that he allowed them to cherry pick out of the big pool of intelligence that's out there, sort of. And it's not really intelligence. You get all this rumors and everything. By the time you call it intelligence, it should be more... A lot of this debate should be resolved. What happened in the end was they made it very easy for certain specific analysts to provide information that told the president what he wanted to hear. When people, analysts, and then later on operations people, raised questions about it, they demanded an extremely high level of proof to prove that it wasn't true, because they didn't want to have to go back to the president. The president had set a tone in the whole administration where you don't go back and tell him that you were wrong. But also, you have to look at George's whole career. George's not an intelligence officer. He came out of Capitol Hill. He's a staff officer. Just what John said. He is used to pleasing his principal, and that's what he was doing here. He was pleasing the principal. The final thing, I think, for me is I believe they all really thought, I think George and I know the others, thought that there were weapons of mass destruction. We just didn't know where they were. And as one guy told me the night before, one very senior guy in George's office told me the night before the war started, he said, I said, you guys sure about that? I said, you know, there must be something else. There must be some super secret thing you're not telling me. And they said, he said, no, this is really, a curveball's really all we've got. He said, but you know, when we get to Baghdad, we're going to find warehouses full of this stuff, and nobody's going to really care where it came from.
Easy assumption, but the facts never showed up. A lot of listeners want to join us. Let me get a call from Iowa City, Iowa. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment here. I worked at NSA in the early to mid-'80s.
National Security Agency, big intelligence operation in its own right. Yep.
Yes, sir. I was in the United States Air Force, low-ranking enlisted person, but the intelligence people there were very professional. I think this administration, you know, used these intelligence people and manipulated the information to their advantage and what they wanted. But again, I just wanted to say that the intelligent people that I work with, and I think, you know, just in general, I think they do a great job. They're very thorough, and I just thought that had to be said.
Kevin, we appreciate it. John Diamond, let me go to you with that. George Tenet made this point repeatedly last night, that in the ranks there are great, serious, and devoted intelligence people. And yet we see what happened here. Tyler Drumheller reminds us that he was a Capitol Hill guy, a kind of political guy. I mean, did he fail as a spokesperson for his own agency? Maureen Dowd, very tough, the New York Times, calls him a lick spittle.
That's a bit rough, but I do think that while the genuine, visceral George Tenet comes across on TV, there is a contrast, because when you read the book and when you sort of lay out the narrative, he's surprisingly passive up the chain of command when there are things he clearly knows to be wrong. It's funny what Tyler just said, because I had a very similar conversation with a senior CIA person at the time, the vice president, in end of summer 02, makes the speech where he comes out saying much more direct and sort of alarming statements about Iraq and WMD than the CIA was saying internally at the time. And I called the agency and said, gee, has something really dramatic come over the transom that has caused the amperage to jump way up on this? And the response I got was, we don't know. You'll have to ask the White House that question, which was just an unheard of kind of response to get from a reporter to the CIA on that. I think that when Tenet complains that, gee, they didn't look at other possibility, they didn't look at that no one asked the question, how imminent was the Iraqi threat? No one asked the question, what would the option of doing sanctions a little longer, what would that do? George Tenet had in his power to order studies of those very questions and chose not to. And it would have been really interesting to see, had those studies been done and the answers come back in contrast to what the administration wanted to do, what Director Tenet at that point would have done with the information. But he didn't even pose the questions. He had to be asked. I think one of the most embarrassing things of the whole WMD fiasco is that the CIA had to be asked to do that national intelligence estimate. It wasn't proactively working on it on its own. They say, gee, the quality wasn't so good because it was a rush job. We had 19 days to do it. Well, Iraq had been discussed all of 2002. Why did they have to wait to be asked? And as flawed as that document is, and it is flawed, it was nevertheless important and revealing, because it revealed the disagreements within the intelligence community on some key things, including the famous aluminum tubes.
Yep.
Here you have hardware in your hands, and the intelligence doesn't get much better than that. You intercept hardware, and still the experts couldn't figure out what it meant. That was revealing in itself.
Ron Suskind, John's been looking at this, but you've paid a lot of attention as well. Does this put Tenet in that traditional role of the CIA chief? Does this make him more of a supplicant to the White House than his predecessors? Did he break the mold here, or is this familiar behavior?
No, it's not familiar. I think the best way to put it is that Tenet represented the old world of evidence, which is really where the intelligence community is, to the new world of action. He was on the crossbeams there, straddling those two worlds, and obviously you see what happened to him. He did not walk in and advocate for evidence, as CIA directors often have in the past, to say the facts do not comport with what you want to do. Now, you policymaker have to make a decision. You can go forward, but there is not evidence to support a particular case that you fancy, period. That's what CIA directors have done for many, many years. George clearly was not doing it and not doing it proactively. And the fact is, at some point, you know, frankly, CIA directors of the past would have said, I'm out the door, because I can't represent an entire kingdom of the United States government marked evidence in this realm. If you want to move forward with that evidence, that's your business. You're the duly elected leader. George didn't do that. He tried to suss it. He tried to manage the mess.
Yep, yep.
And boy, God knows, that catches up with you. It's like a finger in a dike. And the water now, George has been up to his eyes in the water for a long time. And it's hard right now for a lot of people. You know, my friends who watched last night said, yeah, I don't know, Ron. It's really hard for me to take much of what this guy says to the bank.
Tyler, how about it? On the inside, were you and your colleagues watching him at the time, rolling your eyes and saying, why isn't he standing up for what we know?
There, again, as I said, there was a divide inside the agency, and that's what doesn't come across. When he says, this was the best guess, this was the best. It was the best guess that he chose to put forward. There was serious debate all the way through. I mean, the CIA is a large organization, tens of thousands of people. And so you're not, when you get one of these national intelligence estimates, first off, the national intelligence estimate is a bit deceptive anyway, because you act as if, okay, we have this and now we're going to go to war. The fact is, it's only as good as it is on the day it's issued, because new intelligence comes in every day and it changes as it goes. And that's what happened here. The intelligence was discredited. But I think with George, again, you have the way he was with Scott Pelley is the way he is with a lot of people. He's up the ladder, he was very, you know, I have a friend who's a staffer who worked with him years ago outside of the intelligence community, and he said, you know, I tried to put myself in George's shoes, and he said, I can see why he did what he did, the way, but that's not the instinct that you have to be the DCI, saying, I don't want to cause a scene here, maybe I'll take the president aside later, and then it never happens. But the fact is, they knew there were serious problems with the intelligence. Not only did they allow the people to cherry-pick the intelligence, he's right when he says they came in with the idea to go to war and they were looking for reasons to do it, but not only did they allow them to cherry-pick it, they then allowed them to cherry-pick things that they knew were probably not true or very likely were not true.
We're talking this hour about former CIA Director George Tenet and his after-the-fact indictment of the Bush administration and the road to war in Iraq that he shared. Here he is last night, again, on the slam dunk phrase that's been used so much, not least by Vice President Dick Cheney, saying that it was hard for him to hear that used again and again as time went by.
The hardest part of all this has just been listening to this for almost 3 years. Listening to the Vice President go on Meet the Press on the fifth year of 9/11, you know, and say, well, George Tenet said slam dunk, as if he needed me to say slam dunk to go to war with Iraq. And they never let it go. I mean, I became campaign talk. I was a talking point. You know, look what the idiot told us, and we decided to go to war. Well, let's not be so disingenuous. Let's stand up. This is why we did it. This is how we did it. And let's everybody tell the truth.
There's the fury of the fall guy on 60 Minutes last night. Ernest is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Ernest, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You're doing a great job. I mean that sincerely. I listen to you all the time traveling around the state.
Thanks, Ernest. What do you see in this case?
Well, frankly, I'm on Georgia's side.
Okay.
And his reaction last night, the vociferous words he used were very warranted. I happen to be a Greek-American, as George is, and when he states unequivocally that all a man has is his integrity, I have the same pronouncement, if you will. And so I just...
But you only have your integrity if you exercise it. Do you see it exercised sufficiently here, Ernest?
Oh, I do indeed. I do indeed. He has certain restrictions that applied to him, and I think that his intentions were very honorable, without a doubt, Tom.
And it's not just Greek American solidarity talking here, Ernest.
No. I just wanted. There may be a bit of that. We are a minority, but more importantly, we do have some principles. Where did democracy come from, and where did the Platos and the Socrates of the world speak to all of us? I just think that the man has every right to say what he has said, and he was restricted in what he could do because he was in the system.
All right, so let's chalk one up for the Greeks here and look sympathetically for a moment, John Diamond. I mean, he didn't have to come out and say this stuff now. He's got his Medal of Freedom. I suppose he could have grinned and borne it on the slam dunk front. And gone off into the sunset. I mean, are you some kudos to Tenet for giving us something closer to the truth now?
Well, as a journalist, I'm always in favor of people talking rather than not talking. So I'll give him that. I think that if the case was more convincing that he'd been that feisty inside, he would be standing on stronger ground. We do know that Tenet did fight to some degree. He couldn't have been, in a sense, coming under some of the heated criticism he's come under in the past year from within the Bush administration if there hadn't been some pushback coming from George on some of these issues. I find, though, that the slam dunk conversation, that his explanation, I find it in a way more embarrassing than the charge he's trying to refute.
And remind us what that was. He says this was essentially a marketing meeting.
Exactly.
Not that the evidence was a slam dunk, but that John laid out for us.
Well, what he's saying is the evidence was no longer even in question, that the purpose of that meeting was to simply see if the intelligence was persuasive for the idea of selling the war. So he's participating in a sales operation, which is definitely not what the CIA director is supposed to be doing.
To the American people, he's saying, well, it's a slam junk to make this sales job.
Yes, the president gets the presentation from Tenet and his deputy, John McLaughlin. Mm. The president is not impressed. He says, gee, is this the best you can do? And can't you punch this up a little bit? And he says, yes, punching it up will be a slam dunk. I can do that. That's no problem, Mr. President. We'll make it better. I've always found the Bush half of that conversation equally, if not more, revealing. Here, the president of the United States, 3 months before the war, is realizing, hey, you know, the intelligence case for war is not that strong. Mm. And it doesn't cause any kind of reexamination of the policy. It simply causes a reexamination of the material that's going to be rolled out to the public to sell the policy.
Can you punch it up for us, George? Ron Susskind. Now, of course, then comes Woodward's book, and George Tenet very clearly saying somebody in that room, and it was only the president, the VP, Condi Rice, Andy Card, I think that was it, maybe one more. Somebody in there decided to take this slam dunk business, make me look like Tom Cruise on the couch with Oprah Winfrey, and use it to roll up all the blame for the war and put it on my shoulders. Does that strike you as a fair interpretation of what's happened since, Ron?
Well, you know, the whole slam dunk explanation is also in the 1% doctrine from mm-hmm. McLaughlin and, you know, George's view that it was a marketing meeting, it was about selling and advertising and promotion, essentially, mm-hmm. not evidence. And I agree with John. It's an extraordinarily damning denouement to this whole process. Yeah, look, the upshot is that at this point, George has that. It's more than a talking point. That's a sign hanging around his neck, slam dunk. And it will be the dependent clause of his obit, sadly to say.
But do you see an engineered scapegoating here, as he explicitly charges now?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's interesting because the fact is George has gone through a process over the last couple of years. Who dropped the dime on me? You know, everyone in the room dropped the dime on George Tenet. Let's be very frank about that. It wasn't, you know, this person as an outlier, that guy who did something that was not authorized. Everyone in the room made a decision, and they dropped the dime on Tenet. And that's why that appeared in Woodward's book. There was a decision, and the decision essentially had its rendering quite effectively to protect the president against the key charge that history would level, that he took the country to war under false pretenses. George became the firewall to that, and frankly, it held pretty firm for all the key years that they needed it to hold. Now it's getting muddy, and George doesn't remember for a while, and then he's saying it was a marketing meeting. But ultimately, slam dunk served
served its purpose.
Tyler Drumheller, you're very tough on George Tenet's deputy, John McLaughlin, who was at that meeting. You say, cut Tenet a little bit of slack here. He was not well served by his side guy.
Well, I think that's true. I think, again, George is a politician. He came out of the world of politics. And one of the key lessons to learn from this is as they look at reshaping the intelligence community, mm-hmm. which is going to happen over the next couple of years, they're going to have to separate. They're going to have to rebuild a firewall between the politicians and the intelligence officers because it's really corrupted the process now. But John is a longtime 30, 40-year professional analyst, one of the most senior analysts, most respected analysts in the agency, a longtime friend of mine. When they got to the key and the tragedy is, you saw George, if he had been as passionate in his defense of this issue and in taking on this issue with the administration as he was with Scott Pelley last night, there would have been, that's the tragedy of it for me. And the fact is, I think George is the type of guy, if he'd had a strong deputy who said, you know, boss, you're wrong on this, you've got, you know, you got to take a look at it again, it would have had some sway on him. But both of them were looking they were going along with the issue as it was.
Of course, Maureen Dowd, her conclusion is, if you worry about your own survival more than your country's, you might end up as the whiny fall guy. Condoleezza Rice still making the point just over the weekend as the White House sort of rolled out its defense here that they were relying on George Tenet. Let's listen to her on Face the Nation Sunday morning.
When George said slam dunk, everybody understood that he believe that the intelligence was strong? We all believe the intelligence was strong.
Simple as that, says the Secretary of State. Janet's calling from North Charleston, South Carolina. Janet, you're on the air.
Yeah, two points I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. George Tenet may have sincerely believed the weapons of mass destruction were still there, but what they asked Congress to do is to give the president authority to put the inspectors back in to find out. And that's where I fault George Tenet. When they didn't find them, why was he in there? You know, why didn't he speak out then, even if he had to resign his position, saying, hey, the inspectors aren't finding it. Why are we going to go to war?
Mm-hmm. And you had a second point, Janet?
Valerie Plame's job was with Brewster Jennings going into Iraq and Iran looking at nuclear power plants to see if they had weapons of mass destruction. That's treasonous to reveal her identity.
And out it came. Janet, thanks for that. George Tenet, on that point last night about the yellow cake and the charge that Saddam Hussein was getting uranium from Africa, saying, well, let's listen to exactly what he said.
I didn't read the speech. I was involved in a bunch of other things.
Wait a minute. The president's State of the Union address?
I know this shocks and horrifies you.
You didn't read that?
Right, I didn't. Farmed it out, got it at a principal's meeting, brought it down the hall, handed it to my executive assistant. I said, you guys go review this and come back to me if I need to do anything.
Nobody comes back to you.
And therein lies why I ultimately have to take my share of responsibility.
Didn't read the State of the Union speech with the nuclear charge in it. Didn't defend, says our caller, Valerie Plame. Tyler Drumheller, is that fair? Is the director supposed to read all this stuff? And could he, should he have stood up earlier, more effectively somehow, for Valerie Plame, the outed CIA officer?
He didn't read the speech. I was there at the time we were talking about it. But again, you're talking about, you know, he had thousands of things coming across his desk, and
there's only one State of the Union speech per year, and that's a pretty big charge.
Yeah.
Was it a political, I don't have time to read that, you read it, so you'll take the heat, or is it just reasonable?
No, he just didn't do it. I mean, that's the case. He really just didn't do it.
Does that mean he didn't know what was in there? I just want to press that point.
Tom, I can jump in on this. I reported about this in 1% Doctrine. I'm a little more sympathetic to George on this point because, you know, it was a real flood the zone strategy by the White House. It was very close to the speech. It was essentially the day, that afternoon of.
Yep.
And they were flooding the zone at CIA. There were eight things that they were throwing at the same time. And you make your decision whether that was intentional. Let's just leave it at that. But the speech went through, and it ends up being a push and shove between an analyst and some folks at the White House. Pages are being faxed at the last minute. It was a mess, and ultimately that got through. But, you know, there's some intentionality under this, which I think is a little hard to tease out in terms of the White House managing the CIA to make sure that what it wanted in that speech got in the speech, and those evidence guys at CIA are not going to stand in the way. There's quite a bit to that.
Yeah, and that's outplaying the CIA.
Right, that's right.
And, in fact, what happened in that debate was George had been very strong on the point of the yellow cake all along, because that was something that was dismissed as having no credence at all from the very beginning. I mean, that's one of the only reasons it's important is because of what happened to Valerie.
But very strong all along, but not at the moment that it got rolled out as a rationale to the country.
Right. What Ron said is what happened from the White House. They came and they said, okay, the British were reporting the same thing.
Well, yeah.
It came basically from the same source. So they changed the wording of it. But no, it was a moment, you know, whether he didn't want to fight with him and he ignored it or not, it's hard to say. But that really wasn't that speech wasn't the most important part of it. Mm-hmm. It was he did see everything and every issue mm-hmm. that was in the Powell speech. And that's what you shouldn't deflect from mm-hmm. that by these issues. On Valerie Plame,
yes,
he did do the right thing on that. He referred it to the Justice Department right away. He was very upset. I remember that I was there. He was really angry. And he referred it to the Justice Department. And he started the process that led to what happened with Libby.
Let's listen to the sort of summation last night, the way George Tenet hopes to be remembered. Scott Pelley asks him what that legacy will be.
You know that there are people watching this interview, and they're going to say to themselves, that's the guy that missed 9/11. That's the guy who got it wrong on Iraq. To them, you say what?
You know, history will judge who this guy is. All I would say to them is I'm also the guy that was privileged to lead men and women that saved thousands of lives. I'm also the guy that was privileged to lead men and women who get up every day to try and keep them safe. I'm also the guy that knows that my report card is a heck of a lot better than the bad things, and there are a lot of good things. And I would hope that the American people believe that here's a guy who tried to serve his country as best as he knew how, is an honest man, and led his people as well as he possibly could. And the rest is for other people to judge.
George Tenet makes his case. Let's get a last call. Howard from Randolph, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. One of your guests made the point a moment ago that Tenet came from the political side of Washington.
Hmm.
That means he had to have known how the game is played in terms of leaks. He had to have known, and I'm inclined to believe him, but he had to have known that the administration is always going to try to spin intelligence so as to support its positions, regardless of what the intelligence is.
But isn't he supposed to be the counterspin guy in that formula?
I'm sorry?
Isn't he supposed to be the counterspin guy, not the facilitator in that formula?
It doesn't matter. He knows how politics is played. I'd like to hear your guests address this. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. Well, let's get kind of summation here. John Diamond, Howard asks, Scott Pelley asks, in a way, you know, what's the final verdict going to be?
Well, he had, I think, the toughest job in the government over the time span of his tenure. He was dealt a bad hand in the sense that he takes over the agency in 96-97 at a time when, as John McLaughlin said, it was in Chapter 11. Budgets had been down. Manpower was down. They didn't have the right kind of manpower. Tyler, no offense. They didn't have enough of the people with the language skills and so forth. He gets dealt a bad hand. He was political. One quick point I wanted to make, Tom, is the CIA gets criticized for handing in reports that are wishy-washy, that are caveated, mm-hmm. that are sort of on the one hand, on the other hand, which was the nature of the evidence on Iraq.
Yep.
It was very soft. Mm-hmm. And I think that Tenet tried to firm it up to avoid that criticism. Think in retrospect of the service he would have provided for his president. We keep thinking of him as fighting the president. Think of the service he would have provided for the administration had he insisted that any of these statements being made on Iraq have to be heavily caveated because of the uncertainty. Had we gone into war, even if it didn't change the war policy, mm-hmm. but had they gone in with a different framework on the WMD, it would have made a huge difference after the fact for American credibility.
Ron Susskind, history's verdict on this director of CIA intelligence?
Well, I think they'll view it as a Greek tragedy, if you will. Mm. You know, here you've got Tenet actually in his key relationship of the two Georges, feeling gratitude that George Bush didn't fire him after 9/11. Had George Bush done that, Tenet would have been thrown into a deep abyss of censure, unlike almost any other we've seen. Mm. That didn't happen. He felt obligations to Bush, and mostly those obligations got him into enormous trouble when it came to the selling of the Iraq War. That's Greek tragedy.
Right in front of us on display at full book length and $4 million in his pocket. Ron Susskind, author of The 1% Doctrine, thank you very much for being here. John Diamond, we'll talk again when your book on the CIA comes out. And Tyler Drumheller, please stay in our circle. We want to keep posted on how you see things going. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.